All right, we're back in the Farah by-election now, and when you overlay the result of that, it's difficult because it has to be specific to regional areas, really. But you do get a sense, though, of what is achievable for one nation, certainly in the regional and rural areas of Queensland and New South Wales. To me now, it's not impossible for one nation to pick up anywhere between 12 and 22, 23 seats, right? And most of those would be coalition seats, and probably a lot of them National Party in Queensland. You could finish up with a situation, unless the coalition, particularly the Liberal Party, are able to pick up seats in other places and recover a bit from the last result. You could end up with a situation where both One Nation and the coalition have numbers in the 20s.
Yeah, I think one of the big highlights of the Farah by-election to me, everybody's focusing on the 30% primary drop for the Liberal Party.
Yeah, by the way, when I said in the 20s, the numbers I was talking about, seat numbers, not the primary numbers, just to be clear.
30% drop there. But you go back 10 years ago in 2016 in the Farah general election, and the Liberal primary vote was 58%. So it's dropped 45 points since that election. That just shows, you know, how much One Nation are cannibalising their vote overall, and most importantly, though, how much the Liberal Party primary vote has fragmented since 2016. And I think that result also has legitimised One Nation as a political force, because they've now got a seat that they've won in their own right, as opposed to Barnaby Joyce switching parties. And what we've seen in our polling is that creates a bit of a permission structure for One Nation curious voters who are thinking about voting One Nation but are concerned that it's a wasted vote in their language because it's a protest vote. And we've seen in our research, because we've quantified it then, that around 10% of those One Nation curious voters have held back because of concerns that they're just wasting their vote. Now with this result, they will reconsider and say, well, actually, it's a vote for change. So what you might see now is, to get to your point, is that they are going to do very well in a lot of Queensland regional seats, including seats like Leichhardt in Cairns, which is a Labor seat. Hunter is going to be in diabolical trouble. That's a two-party contest last time between One Nation and Labor. So they will pick up a few seats from Labor, but it will mostly be from the coalition pile. Barnaby has been very ambitious and sort of done the sort of Babe Ruth, you know, we're coming after Western Sydney. I think there's a few seats that might, on a sunny day, turn One Nation. But obviously, if you've got, say, $10 million campaign funding for One Nation, you're going to go for the lowest hanging fruit before you start sort of being too ambitious in the western suburbs of Sydney. There are preconditions in Western Sydney with economic insecurity and cultural conservatism and a few other issues like that. But I can see them putting a lot of resources into those regional seats and ending up with a significant number.
Now, I want to get back to that Western Sydney thing, but when you were talking about the fact that One Nation voters now have had a look at this, they don't want to waste their vote, and they're starting to think, well, it won't be wasted. That's just another version of the thoughts that I've had on this anyway, that what motivates those who used to vote for the Liberals and National Party and are now voting for One Nation, and it's all of it. It's things like, you know, frustration from the system and cost of living and burning the house down and the whole thing. But one thing that they have in common, all of them, those who have deserted the National Party and the Liberal Party and are joining One Nation, what all of those have in common is they want to bring down Labor governments. That's what really inspires them. And they looked at what happened at the last election, at the last federal election, and they felt, well, the coalition was no longer an effective or popular vehicle. You know, it became the kind of P76 of Australian politics. Yeah. And so they want to try a new one. And what they will do, they'll certainly road test it now, I think, as a result of Farah. They'll road test it all the way through to the next election, no question. And that's what Farah has done. It's made the idea of voting for One Nation more sustainable for a lot of their people. When you mentioned, though, the Western Sydney, that does become interesting. But I looked at Griffith, and I think it was 3 out of 4 booths in Griffith went to One Nation, but not at the same rate as in some other places, and one of the booths didn't. But the difference with those western suburbs, whether in most of the cities, is that there are leaders of these ethnic groups who are influential, they're visible, and they get involved. And that wouldn't have happened at the by-election, but you can bet your life when all of the attention comes on with all the extra heat of the federal election that those communities will be whipped up. And one nation can't expect to walk in there and get the same result.
Yeah, there was a few lessons for Labor as well in Farah. They didn't have a candidate in the field, of course, but with no candidate in the field, you'd think intuitively that their vote would have gone to the independent, who was funded by Climate 200, so had Labor tendencies, as well as the Greens. What's been lost in the last couple of weeks in the Nepean by-election in Farah, because the headline has been One Nation, for obvious reasons, and a collapse in the Liberal primary vote in Farah in particular. But the Greens did not benefit from no Labor candidate in Nepean. They improved their vote by 0.5%.
Yep.
And in Farah, they went back 2.5 points. So there's something happening on the left flank right now. Greens voters have always been very tactical in the way they think and vote. So we've seen before in previous elections, and this includes some teal voters as well, where the outcome they want might be Anthony Albanese as Prime Minister, but they feel, let's take, for example, the issue of climate change, that Labor are only a little bit better than the Coalition on climate change, and they need to be dragged kicking and screaming. So it's a modern version of Don Chip. I'm going to vote Teals or Greens, but the outcome I want is Anthony Albanese as Prime Minister, but I want to put pressure on him on my issue. What I think is happening now is that these Greens voters, and this happened, I think, at the last election with the possibility of Dutton winning, they've sort of gone back home to Labor. They voted tactically again because what we saw was three Green seats lost, and Labor have briefed out that there was a Dutton factor there. They were spooked about Dutton possibly winning and they wanted to make sure that Albanese won. I think it's happening again, more so, with the rise of One Nation. They don't want to see the populist right, and so they're going back home. So you might see Labor lose some votes to One Nation, that economically anxious, precarious cohort, but then picking up some from the Green pile as well.
Yeah, and you mentioned that, you know, why isn't some of the dissatisfaction with Labor being picked up by the Greens? And when I did that forum in Farah, a lot of people said to me afterwards that the candidate that they were most impressed with was the Greens candidate. He turned up with a support dog called Havoc, a Labrador.
Yeah.
he really did, I think, articulate his position very convincingly, and he got a poor result, even with Labor not in the hunt. So there is something that they need to look at there. Pauline Hanson, too, obviously needs to broaden her appeal beyond just being had a gutful of everything that's going on. She seems to be hinting that she might have something to say on gas.
Yeah, at the election night party they had for the winning candidate, David Farley, she gave a speech where she said that they were going to unveil an energy policy centred around taking more money from gas exports while also securing equity for taxpayers. That sounds like the Norway sovereign fund to me. And I know from previous polling, you know, adjacent to this issue, that's going to be very popular, I think, because we still get it in focus groups, voters left and right angry about the privatisation of electricity. And they'll say things like, you know, Daniel Andrews at the last Victorian state election talked about $23 billion of profits have gone to multinationals since privatisation of electricity. That just got spat back at us at focus groups, and people are saying that's $23 billion that could have gone into health, education, roads and so forth. Now, the truth of it is it's gone to shareholders and superannuation funds. That's part of our superannuation scheme and pensions. However, that's what voters heard. I think that sort of policy, when they talk about a $3 trillion sovereign wealth fund like Norway, I think it could go down very well with voters.
Well, when you talk about both the left and the right, if you put the question to people at focus groups about taxing the larger taxes on these international oil companies as gas leaves Australia, how popular is it from 1 to 10?
The initial research post-budget this week, and people are still processing it. Now they've got fragmented information paths. The days of sort of listening to the radio, reading the newspaper, watching the TV are sort of long gone. They get their information from things like Reddit and peer-to-peer messaging and so forth. content shared on Instagram from mainstream media. They're still sort of processing the information. They are aware that there's new taxes. I've got to say, they haven't been overwhelmed with a budget. They don't like the idea of, you know, it might be millennials being in the focus group. They don't like the idea of Gen X and boomers being taxed more. They're a bit uncomfortable with that. But it is amazing how many have, on an unprompted basis, said, why aren't they taxing gas?
Yeah.
Why are they taxing my dad or my grandparents? Why are they taxing gas? Now, it's not as simple as that, but that's the perception. I think Albanese is going to have a lot of trouble not going there at the next budget strategically.
Yeah, absolutely.
By the way, Barry, on Wednesday night after the budget, do you know what the lead story was on Channel 10 in Sydney?
No idea.
Ivan Cleary was retiring as Penrith coach. That was the lead story. So sometimes we can get immersed in all these issues surrounding the budget, but the most important issues are NRL in Sydney, and it was a salient reminder.
I've got a little anecdote on that one too, going all the way back to when Bob Hawke cried at a news conference when he was talking about his family and the drugs and things, and people were kind of a bit confused by why did that happen. And he decided, I think, that maybe Hazel would go on A Current Affair and explain it all. And it was a Monday, Monday night, so Tuesday. He was shocked to observe that Hazel had knocked the Brownlow off page one. So these things are important.
That's brilliant.
An email from Jonathan just to finish up on, and he had a go at me in particular. He didn't like me using the expression middle-class welfare when I referred to negative gearing and capital gains taxes, and he wrote that Tony was right to push back, and pointing to Phil Currie's opinion in the Fin Review that increasing taxes on capital to boost revenue is not reform, it's just revenue collection dressed up as reform. But my point is, it's essential to tax capital. And revenue raising is essential. It's part of the system. But, you know, it's at the heart of the big question. And I know you're starting to take a second look at Tucker Carlson like all of us at the moment, Tony. But I was listening to one of his podcasts the other day, and he goes on about this all the time. He raises this question constantly. Why do we tax labour at twice the rate of capital? So it's an emerging thought. And it's coming from interesting places.
Yep. No, I like the cut of Jonathan's jib. But I think there's an overwhelming argument to change the taxation rates for income earners, and the way how assets and property are treated needs to be changed. So I think Labor's addressed that part of it, albeit a little imperfectly, not the way I would have liked, but they really do need to tackle this income tax thing. And I think, you know, I think next year there'll be gas, and then the year after there'll be generous income tax cuts, is my fearless prediction.
Okay, well, that's it for today. Again, join us if you can at Carriage Works in Sydney at the Sydney Writers Festival, 9 a.m. on Thursday. It's a free event. This podcast was made on the sovereign lands of the Wurundjeri people. It was produced by Daniel Simo, video production Charisma Luthria.
The executive producer is Hannah Parks.
I'm Barry Cassidy.
And I'm Tony Barry, and this is Back to Back Barry's, a Guardian Australia podcast.